This is an ABC podcast.
Farmers have welcomed extra drought assistance funding today, but they say the money does little to ease their worries about the cycle of drought.
You know, we don't know where we are in the cycle of this drought. We could well be in the middle. And in some cases it's been going for 5 or 6 years. And we could have, a significant period of that time to go.
And how many of Australia's 2,500 wineries can survive?
Actually, it's not that hard to make money. It's a matter of spreadsheets and planning, just like any other business. But there's a romance about wine, and people kind of resist the idea that that they should sit down with an Excel spreadsheet and work it out.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide. Fresh from his tour of the United States, Prime Minister Scott Morrison has taken a first-hand look at conditions on the drought-stricken Western Darling Downs in Queensland. The Prime Minister announced extra drought support from a farm near Dalby, about 230 kilometres west of Brisbane. The $100 million package will include emergency payments of up to $3,000 for cash-strapped farmers, contractors and their families. 13 drought-ravaged councils across the country will each receive $1 million for water infrastructure upgrades, mental health support and other projects. Here's a little of what the Prime Minister had to say from Dalby.
It's not set and forget, our drought response. It is ongoing. We are listening very carefully. That's why we're here today. That's why my feet barely touched the ground after getting back from New York yesterday and straight back up here to both commend Dave and his family on the amazing work they do living through this drought. And it's always great, even when you come to places like this.
Today's visit by the PM follows an Instagram campaign by farmers calling for greater drought support. Farmers have posted photos of dry paddocks all over the country on the hashtag Scott Morrison, where are you? Lydia Burton was in Dalby to find out what farmers thought of the extra drought assistance, and she filed this report.
Driving into this property, it really sets the scene for the Prime Minister today. There's not a crop in the ground here, which is very unusual. As to what the Prime Minister's announcements mean for farmers actually on the ground, I'm joined by AgForce Grains President Brendan Taylor. Brendan, what do you make of the PM's announcement today?
Look, AgForce are hugely supportive of this announcement today, and the federal government need to be commended on taking this step in what for some people is really quite dire circumstances.
One of the announcements was about extending the farm household allowance to include the criteria so that if you have off-farm income of up to $100,000 that you can still get access to the farm household allowance. What do you make of that measure?
Look, Lydia, that's a welcome announcement today. For people that have taken that step to diversify or even go out and get a job because things are so tough on the farm, before this, that would have ruled them out of being able to access the farm household allowance. And now, either their partner or their wife could take off-farm income up to that value and still be eligible for this support. So it's a welcome announcement.
Another measure announced today was $3,000 cash payments for farmers that would be distributed through the Salvation Army and the like. You know, some farmers in this area haven't had a decent crop for 2 years. Do you think $3,000 will really make a difference?
Look, it's in the scheme of things, it's going to help put food on the table, and that's it's not meant to keep people afloat as such. It's just to help with that everyday bills, the power bill, maybe the rates, but it's purely and simply just a hardship type payment to put food on the table. There are examples of people right across this region, particularly further south, that have had 50 to 70 mils of rain this year. And they will be hurting. It's very hard to imagine. Personally, where we are, we've only had 150 mil of rain this year, which is not much in the scheme of things, considering our average is 600 to 650 sort of range. So to be in that well below 100 range, people will be in quite dire circumstances. Just paying those everyday bills, unless they've got a significant way of earning some other income off farm.
And the problem is, you know, we're nearly in October and the forecast doesn't even look that good for the next couple of months. Would you have liked to have seen more from the Prime Minister today?
We can't ask for everything, but we're very welcome with what we've got today. And finally, the government are taking this drought seriously, and it's very serious. And, you know, we don't know where we are in the cycle of this drought. We could well be in the middle, and in some cases it's been going for 5 or 6 years. And we could have, a significant period of that time to go. And, it's a watching brief, and the Prime Minister needs to be commended for taking this action. And I hope they do keep a very close eye on it, because, if we go through this summer without significant rainfall, we come to January, February next year without significant rainfall through this summer, things will be a lot less worse than they already are.
You say, this is a sign that the government is taking this drought seriously. To be honest, there's nothing overwhelming or, really incredible in this package. As you say, they're all welcomed measures. Really, we need rain. But is it just about having the Prime Minister, in your neck of the woods? Your place is just down the road from here. Is that what you'd like to see? Just acknowledgement from having the Prime Minister come and stand on your dry paddocks?
Yeah, sure. I don't recall the last time a Prime Minister's been out here to visit us on the Downs. It's a great place. We've got lots of fertile soil. We've got lots of feedlots around here that are bulging with cattle at the moment, but due to the lack of rainfall, we can't produce any grain to sustain that. So we're welcoming him here anytime.
Brendan Taylor ending that report from Lydia Burton, and she was reporting there from the Western Darling Downs in Queensland.
ABC Australia Wide.
I've had a good life, but I am the new homeless, as are many other well-educated people.
On ABC Radio.
The Queensland Government and dam operator Sunwater this week announced more than 100,000 megalitres of water will be released from Paradise Dam near Bundaberg due to safety concerns. The announcement came as a shock to many, as the region is in drought, and farmers were particularly surprised as they weren't consulted about the decision. Nicole Hegarty reports from Bundaberg.
The storage level of Paradise Dam will be lowered. The spillway will be lowered by 5 metres. The decision to release water from this dam has not been taken lightly.
Bundaberg irrigators first heard of the decision to reduce the dam's capacity from 75% to 42% via email on Tuesday morning. Queensland's Natural Resources Minister, Anthony Lynham, and Sunwater made the public announcement later that day.
We understand that this area is drought declared, and that's why the 80,000 megalitres that are released will be available free of charge to those farmers who normally use the water from Paradise Dam.
Dam operator Sunwater says new modelling shows potential problems with the spillway if there's a repeat of the devastating 2013 flood, which inundated more than 2,000 homes as the Burnett River rose to a record 9.53 metres. Sunwater Chair Leith Bowley says the decision to reduce the dam's storage is final.
We must begin these works immediately. The community of Bundaberg is safe, and our intention is to make sure that the community here stays safe.
Local irrigators say the majority of the water will go out to sea, as many don't have crops in the ground at this stage of the season. Mark Mimino from the Sunwater Bundaberg Irrigation Advisory Committee says the decision doesn't sit well with irrigators.
I struggle to comprehend that a decision like this can be made when we've got areas of Queensland in the worst drought for a long period of time. We've had large fires where the firefighters struggle to find water to put fires out with, and now we're just going to see potentially a large volume of water released to sea.
Bundaberg Mayor Jack Dempsey says council was told the decision to lower the dam's capacity was based on recent core samples that examined the dam's construction.
This is the largest failure of a piece of infrastructure in Queensland's history.
He wants the technical report referenced as a basis for the announcement to be made public. Sunwater has held a series of community drop-in sessions in Bundaberg since the announcement. Bundaberg avocado and macadamia grower Joe Lyons went along to the first of the public sessions and says while he's happy about getting free water in the short term, he's worried about water security with reduced ongoing capacity.
It is what it is. I mean, they have to lower the dam wall to fix it. Yes, I'd love to say that we could use every drop of that water, but It's not going to happen. We just got to make the most of a bad situation.
Opposition leader Deb Fracklington has called for the decision to be reversed, saying fixing the dam is a much better option.
To release this amount of water without any consultation to the local community clearly shows how out of touch Anastasia Palaszczuk is. We should always keep the community safe, but it shouldn't be at the risk of losing this amount of water.
Water engineer John McIntosh from Engineers Australia says dropping the dam capacity will successfully reduce pressure on the wall and its foundations.
Dropping the water level, you do two things. One, you expose areas so that you can examine it. Secondly, and most importantly, you reduce the load from the dam. By dropping the water level by 5 metres, will reduce the forces on the dam dramatically, and it removes the risk of anything untoward happening.
An independent review into the dam and the local community's readiness for another significant flood will start next month.
Nicole Hegarty reporting there from Bundaberg. The Australian wine industry could be in for a shake-up in the years ahead due to what's being described as an overcrowded market. Winemakers and industry representatives from around the world recently met in the cool climate wine region of Orange in the New South Wales Central West. Among the issues discussed was how can you make money with wine? Tim Fuchs reports.
The idea of owning a winery and making wine sounds like a wonderful lifestyle choice, but it's not so easy making it a business. Australia has nearly 2,500 wineries across 65 wine regions, mostly family-owned small operations. Felicity Carter is the editor of a wine magazine based in Germany, and she says the issue of a market inundated with wineries is a worldwide problem.
A huge proportion of the wine industry internationally is not profitable. There's too many people who are get into it for the lifestyle, and so don't really understand the economics of it very well. And actually, it's not that hard to make money. It's a matter of spreadsheets and planning, just like any other business. But there's a romance about wine, and people kind of resist the idea that that they should sit down with an Excel spreadsheet and work it out. If you look at a country like France, the area under vine is shrinking because children don't want to take over their parents' farms because they can see how unprofitable it is and how hard their parents worked. So what's happening there is beginning to spread internationally. Yeah, so we're going to see a contraction in the next 10 years.
So, are there too many wineries in Australia? Matthew Moat is the CEO of Wine Industry Suppliers Australia. To stay in business, he says wineries need to give the customer an experience these days that'll have them coming back.
It's no longer good enough just to make good wine. You've actually got to deliver an experience. I like to sort of use the analogy of music. You can get music anywhere on Spotify and so forth as a commodity, but what people really pay good money for is actually going to the concert and having that experience. And wine's no different. I can buy wine at my local bottle shop very easily, but if I'm going to travel and invest in going out to a region, I really want to have that experience if you're going to get more dollars out of my pocket.
Nicole Samadol is president of the Orange Region Vignerons Association and owner of Rowley Wines, where she operates a small cellar door. Like others, she's aware of how many wineries there are, but knows there are ways of standing out above the crowd.
It is a crowded market. Australia, New South Wales and Orange are very fortunate, and we have very high quality wines, cool climate wines that people are seeking out more and more. And we've got a very engaged and enthusiastic local customer base, and they often bring their friends and relatives to the region. So it's really about how to share our love of cool climate wine with them and encourage them to become repeat customers.
Around 75% of wine consumed in Australia is produced locally. Part of the discussion at the conference has looked at the importance of the traditional wine clubs as a way of encouraging people to drink Australian-produced wine. Dean Taylor has set up a new business supplying wine through internet orders. While smaller wineries struggle to get their wine into the supermarkets or large liquor chains these days, he says consumers want to be able to order wine online in the morning and have it delivered on their doorstep later that day. And Mr. Taylor says consumers still want to try a variety of wine, particularly from those smaller wineries.
Most consumers these days are actually really interested in trying lots of new wines. They go out of their way to find wines that they haven't tried before, and I guess they're when they're choosing those wines, they're looking for those that are the most authentic and, I guess, are brands that reflect their own personalities. So, you know, now, you know, where people used to typically buy the same wine and they'd buy, you know, 12 bottles of the same wine or maybe six, we're finding that people are going out of their way to choose six different wines or 12 different wines because they want to explore wine. I mean, it's sort of, it's, I guess it's become part of that whole culinary experience in this country.
Wine supplier Dean Taylor, ending that report by Tim Fuchs.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
It's a species that I have been fighting for.
Growing up in the bush is such a special thing.
So when the rain does come, we've got a few numbers.
What
got
if
a...
it never come?
Put a feather in your cap.
ABC Radio.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan. There aren't many positives to the ongoing drought, but less water is an opportunity to make a big impact on feral pigs. And new research using satellite tracking technology is making the job even easier. Sean Murphy reports.
They're hand-feeding cattle in the northwest of New South Wales, and feral pigs are filling their bellies with the precious drought rations meant for hungry livestock. It's an ideal place for Darren Marshall to set his traps.
Pigs are really opportunistic, you know. They're just chasing that protein so they can keep that 15% protein so that they can breed.
Darren traps pigs for science. For 2 years, he's been capturing them under contract to try to learn more about how to control them.
Done. The idea is to use science to motivate landholders to participate in coordinated control.
Yep.
The big problem out here is to some people and some enterprises, feral pigs are a massive issue. People are taking devastating agricultural losses to all of their crops, like cotton, sorghum, wheat. But then we have other enterprises that the pigs don't really have an impact on. So because they don't have that impact, those landholders aren't as motivated to take as much action.
So far, he's recorded data on more than 120 pigs at four locations in New South Wales and Queensland. But the centrepiece of the research project, GPS satellite tracking collars that can record where pigs go and when they go there.
This collar will take a GPS point every half an hour, and then every 6 hours, it'll transmit up to a satellite and come back to us.
The early results have been groundbreaking, and the project has been expanded to 9 locations in those 2 states.
The biggest thing that surprised me is how little the pigs move. So this is one site, we have 9 others, and on all of those sites, pigs aren't moving great expansive distances. You always hear stories about pigs living in the national park and travelling 30, 40 kilometres a night to come and smash a crop, and then travelling back. We're just not seeing that.
Pig numbers continue to grow even in the grip of drought. They are prolific breeders. Sows are capable of producing 2 litters every year, with up to 10 viable piglets each in a good year. They're adding to the burden for farmers unable to grow crops and struggling to feed their livestock.
Fence up and see if that brings those numbers back down a bit.
Jason Phillips runs an 1,800-hectare cropping operation between Moree and Narrabri. Even with the best advice from agronomist Tony Lockery, he's been unable to grow any winter crops this year.
Hello, Jason. We go sorghum and mung beans ago here the last couple of years, and we had them flogged by pigs.
Tony Lockery is a contract aerial shooter as well as an agronomist.
The information that Darren and the project have been able to generate it's world class. We don't have anything like that sort of information to draw on. So to have that and to have it locally here, to be able to see the home range of the pigs that we're dealing with, to be able to see their habits, where they're camping, where they're feeding, where they're watering, makes it we'll be much more targeted in how we look to manage the pigs in this area.
Oh, it's some sound. That's agronomist Tony Lockery ending that report from Sean Murphy. And you can catch Sean's full story on Landline on ABC TV on Sunday from 12:30 and anytime you like on ABC iView.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
He didn't want to go to school. He didn't want to leave my side.
Yeah, a lot of family violence in homes when I was growing up.
You know, you take out insurance hoping that it never happens, but if it does, you want them to have your back.
On ABC Radio.
There's nothing nicer than to dive into one of Australia's ocean pools. There are no stingers, no sharks, and no waves to worry about. Our reporter, Eloise Farrow-Smith, chats to a small but passionate type of traveller, the ocean pool tourist.
I love it when people get hold of me and say, you know, where shall I go? In fact, I had a guy just this week email me, say he's planning a big drive from Noosa down to Melbourne. Which pool should he not miss as a tourist driving down? It's fantastic. I think it's great to create these people who want to go and do the same thing and maybe not as obsessively doing one by one like I did, but want to pick out highlights. I think it's great to be a pool tourist.
That's Yorkshireman Simon Duffin. When he arrived to live in Australia in 2014, he was overcome by the beauty of Australia's ocean pools, but baffled by the lack of information on how to find them.
What I would have liked as a newcomer in Australia was a map showing me where all these pools are. And nobody had done that online, so I created the website to do precisely that, and in which I could then express my own experiences on it. But the map is quite important to it.
His next 3 years he spent visiting every tidal bath, rock pool or ocean bath in his new home state of New South Wales.
And actually it took me in New South Wales all the way to the coast from Ballina down to Eden, in fact. So, I mean, I've documented, I think it's 85 ocean pools and about 20 or 30 harbour baths with swimming nets. So they're also in salt water.
That's come in use for fellow pool tourist Liz Moore, who shares a love of salt water.
I love floating. I'm treading water, so just that idea of not being able to touch any of the surfaces that are around me is I've always loved. I love deep water.
But when Liz began to lose her vision, things changed.
When my health and vision started to deteriorate, I became very fearful. I found it very difficult to walk in the sand. I became fearful of the waves.
3 years ago, Liz decided she'd had enough of her disability curtailing her love of salt water. She found Simon Duffin's blog.
We started researching pools and then came across the website with all the pool ratings, and it was it's like it was written just for me. It was ideal. The website's got all of the things that I want to know in deciding whether to go to an ocean pool. How to get into it, how to get out of it is a big thing for me with a vision and joint mobility issues. Location, parking, the reviews are fabulous. So it was an absolute blessing to find that sort of information out there where I hadn't been able to find that before.
Liz Moore has been back in the water for 3 years now, exploring ocean pools from Bondi to Wollongong.
In the ocean pool, you get the best of the beach lifestyle without the fear of the wave crashing on your head. Our vacations tend to be on the coast. When we're looking at spaces to go, now we actually look at ocean pools. So our recent trip to Newcastle was on the premise that there are literally two ocean pools beside each other. So for my husband and I, it was an ultimate destination. We picked our destination based on the fact that there was an ocean pool there.
She goes to great lengths to find her moments of ritual.
Just a float in a... That to me is, if you get that for 30 seconds or a couple of minutes, that's the pinnacle, that's the ultimate of having an ocean swim, is being able to just float without anybody running into you or you running into anyone.
If you think being a pool tourist is all about fun and games, spare a thought for Kenton Webb. He's on a quest to get wet, which will take around 50 years. He's a man on a mission as he travels Australia and beyond for his aquatic odyssey.
It's 1,000 metres in 1,000 pools, so the goal is to swim a kilometre, at least, in 1,000 different pools anywhere in the world.
Kenton's just clocked halfway, 516 pools to be exact. That's taken 28 years, he's now 49 years old. At this rate, he'll need to put some grunt into his stroke. But as a swimmer well knows, it's not about the last lap. It's the visceral experience that drives the quest to get wet.
It's the closest thing I can imagine to flying, because you're looking down at this vast expanse of blue. So beautiful, you can hop into them at one end and you can see the other end as if there's nothing there, and you just float through it and it's wonderful. The sensation of being suspended in the water and the water moving across your body is nothing like it.
I have to say, as an ocean swimmer myself, I have to agree with that. Eloise Farrow-Smith with that story. And you can see the last instalment of the ABC's Ode to Australia's Love Affair with the Pool on TV on Sunday night. And that's all from the Australia-wide team for this week. Myself and Alex will be taking a short holiday, and the team in Broome are going to host Australia-wide. So Vanessa Mills will be in the chair on Monday. Have a great long weekend, wherever you are. I'm Sinead Mangan. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.